We were all dressed up, and we stood there in front of those sweating black men, sucking ice out of our handkerchiefs, leaning forward a little so as not to drip water on our dresses. There were other children there, barefoot, naked to the waist, dirty. But we stood apart, near the car, in white stockings, ribbons, and gloves. And when he talked to the men, he kept glancing at us and the car and us. You see, he took us there so they could see us, envy him. Then one of the little boys came over to us and put his hand on Corinthian's hair. She offered him her piece of ice, and before we knew it, he was running toward us. He knocked the ice out of her hand into the dirt and shoved us both into the car. First he displayed us, then he splayed us. All our lives were like that. He would parade us like virgins through Babylon, then humiliate us like whores in Babylon. Now he has knocked the ice out of Corinthian's hand again, and you are to blame. Magdalene Colina was crying. You are to blame. You are a sad, pitiful, stupid, selfish, hateful man. I hope your little hog's gut stands you in good stead, and that you take good care of it because you don't have anything else. But I want to give you notice. She pulled her glasses out of her pocket and put them on. Her eyes doubled in size behind the lenses and were very pale and cold. I don't make roses anymore, and you have pissed your last in this house. Milkman said nothing. Now, she whispered, get out of my room. Milkman turned and walked across the room. It was good advice, he thought. Why not take it? He closed the door. Part 2, Chapter 10. When Hansel and Gretel stood in the forest and saw the house in the clearing before them, the little hairs at the nape of their necks must have shivered. Their knees must have felt so weak that blinding hunger alone could have propelled them forward. No one was there to warn or hold them. Their parents, chastened and grieving, were far away. So they ran as fast as they could to the house where a woman older than death lived, and they ignored the shivering nape hair and the softness in their knees. A grown man can also be energized by hunger, and any weakness in his knees or irregularity in his heartbeat will disappear if he thinks his hunger is about to be assuaged, especially if the object of his craving is not gingerbread or chewy gumdrops, but gold. Milkman ducked under the boughs of black walnut trees and walked straight toward the big crumbling house. He knew that an old woman had lived in it once, but he saw no signs of life there now. He was oblivious to the universe of woodlife that did live there in layers of ivy grown so thick he could have sunk his arm in it up to the elbow. Life that crawled, life that slunk and crept and never closed its eyes. Life that burrowed and scurried, and life so still it was indistinguishable from the ivy stems on which it lay. Birth, life, and death, each took place on the hidden side of a leaf. From where he stood, the house looked as if it had been eaten by a galloping disease, the sores of which were dark and fluid. 1 mile behind him were macadam and the reassuring sounds of an automobile or two, one of which was Reverend Cooper's car driven by his 13-year-old nephew. "Noon," Milkman had told him. "Come back at noon." He could just as easily have said 20 minutes. And now that he was alone, assaulted by what city people regard as raucous silence, he wished he had said 5 minutes. But even if the boy hadn't had chores to do, it would be foolish to be driven 15 miles outside Danville on business and stay a hot minute. He should never have made up that elaborate story to disguise his search for the cave. Somebody might ask him about it. Besides, lies should be very simple, like the truth. Excessive detail was simply excess. But he was so tired after the long bus ride from Pittsburgh, coming right after the luxury of the flight, he was afraid he wouldn't be convincing. The airplane ride exhilarated him, encouraged illusion and a feeling of invulnerability. High above the clouds, heavy yet light, caught in the stillness of speed, cruise, the pilot said. Sitting in intricate metal, become glistening bird, it was not possible to believe he had ever made a mistake, or could. Only one small thought troubled him. That guitar was not there, too. He would have loved it, the view, the food, the stewardesses. But Milkman wanted to do this by himself, with no input from anybody. This one time, he wanted to go solo. In the air, away from real life, he felt free. But on the ground, when he talked to guitar just before he left, the wings of all those other people's nightmares flapped in his face and constrained him. Lena's anger, Corinthian's loose and uncombed hair, matching her slack lips. Ruth's stepped-up surveillance, his father's bottomless greed, Hager's hollow eyes. He did not know whether he deserved any of that, but he knew he was fed up, and he knew he had to leave quickly. He told the guitar of his decision before he told his father. "Daddy thinks the stuff is still in the cave." "Could be," guitar sipped his tea. "Anyway, it's worth checking out. At least we'll know once and for all." "I couldn't agree more." "So I'm going after it." "By yourself?" Milkman sighed. Yeah, by myself. I need to get out of here. I mean, I really have to go away somewhere." Guitar put his cup down and folded his hands in front of his mouth. "Wouldn't it be easier with the two of us? Suppose you have trouble." "It might be easier, but it might look more suspicious with two men instead of one roaming around the woods. If I find it, I'll haul it back, and we'll split it up, just like we agreed. If I don't, well, I'll be back anyway." "When you leaving?" "Tomorrow morning." "What's your father say about you going alone?" "I haven't told him yet. You're the only one knows so far." Milkman stood up, went to the window that looked out on Guitar's little porch. Shit. Guitar was watching him carefully. "What's the matter?" he asked. "Why are you so low? You don't act like a man on his way to the end of the rainbow." Milkman turned around and sat on the sill. "I hope it is a rainbow, and nobody has run off with the pot, 'cause I need it. Everybody needs it." "Not as bad as me," Guitar smiled. "Look like you really got the itch now, more than before." "Yeah, well, everything's worse than before. Or maybe it's the same as before, I don't know. I just know that I want to live my own life. I don't want to be my old man's office boy no more. And as long as I'm in this place, I will be. Unless I have my own money. I have to get out of that house, and I don't want to owe anybody when I go. My family's driving me crazy. Daddy wants me to be like him and hate my mother. My mother wants me to think like her and hate my father. Corinthians won't speak to me. Lena wants me out, and Hagar wants me chained to her bed or dead. Everybody wants something from me, you know what I mean? Something they think they can't get anywhere else. Something they think I got. I don't know what it is. I mean, what it is they really want. Guitar stretched his legs. They want your life, man. My life? What else? No, Hagar wants my life. My family, they want... I don't mean that way. I don't mean they want your dead life. They want your living life. You're losing me, said Milkman. Look, it's the condition our condition is in. Everybody wants the life of a black man. Everybody. White men want us dead or quiet, which is the same thing as dead. White women, same thing. They want us, you know, universal, human. No race consciousness. Tame, except in bed. They like a little racial loincloth in the bed. But outside the bed, they want us to be individuals. You tell them, but they lynched my papa. And they say, yeah, but you're better than the lynchers are, so forget it. And black women, they want your whole self. Love, they call it. And understanding. Why don't you understand me? What they mean is, don't love anything on earth except me. They say, be responsible. But what they mean is, don't go anywhere where I ain't. You try to climb Mount Everest, they'll tie up your ropes. Tell them you want to go to the bottom of the sea just for a look, they'll hide your oxygen tank. Or you don't even have to go that far. Buy a horn and say you want to play. Oh, they love the music, but only after you pull 8 at the post office. Even if you make it, even if you're stubborn and mean and you get to the top of Mount Everest, or you do play and you good, real good, that still ain't enough. You blow your lungs out on the horn and they want what breath you got left to hear about how you love them. They want your full attention. Take a risk, and they say you're not for real, that you don't love them. They won't even let you risk your own life, man, your own life, unless it's over them. You can't even die unless it's about them. What good is a man's life if he can't even choose what to die for? Nobody can choose what to die for. Yes, you can, and if you can't, you can damn well try to. You sound bitter. If that's what you feel, why are you playing your numbers game, keeping the racial ratio the same and all? Every time I ask you what you're doing it for, you talk about love, loving Negroes. Now you say, it is about love. What else but love? Can't I love what I criticize? Yeah, but except for skin color, I can't tell the difference between what the white women want from us and what the colored women want. You say they all want your life, a living life. So if a colored woman is raped and killed, why do the days rape and kill a white woman? Why worry about the colored woman at all? Guitar cocked his head and looked sideways at Milkman. His nostrils flared a little. Because she's mine. Yeah, sure. Milkman didn't try to keep disbelief out of his voice. So everybody wants to kill us except black men, right? Right. Then why did my father, who was a very black man, try to kill me before I was even born? Maybe he thought you were a little girl, I don't know. But I don't have to tell you that your father is a very strange Negro. He'll reap the benefits of what we sow, and there's nothing we can do about that. He behaves like a white man, thinks like a white man. As a matter of fact, I'm glad you brought him up. Maybe you can tell me how, after losing everything his own father worked for to some crackers, after seeing his father shot down by them, how can he keep his knees bent? Why does he love them so? And Pilate, she's worse. She saw it too, and first goes back to get a cracker's bones for some kind of crazy self-punishment, and second, leaves the cracker's gold right where it was. Now, is that voluntary slavery or not? She slipped into those Jemima shoes 'cause they fit. Look, Qatar, first of all, my father doesn't care whether a white man lives or swallows lie. He just wants what they have. And Pilate is a little nuts, but she wanted us out of there. If she hadn't been smart, both of our asses would be cooling in the joint right now. My ass, not yours. She wanted you out, not me. Come on, that ain't even fair. No, fair is one more thing I've given up. But to Pilate? What for? She knew what we did, and still she bailed us out. Went down for us, clowned, and crawled for us. You saw her face. You ever see anything like it in your life? Once. Just once, said Qatar. And he remembered anew how his mother smiled when the white man handed her the $4 $10 bills. More than gratitude was showing in her eyes. More than that, not love, but a willingness to love. Her husband was sliced in half and boxed backward. He'd heard the millmen tell how the two halves, not even fitted together, were placed cut side down, skin side up in the coffin, facing each other, each eye looking deep into its mate, each nostril inhaling the breath the other nostril had expelled, the right cheek facing the left, the right elbow crossed over the left elbow. And he had worried then, as a child, that when his father was wakened on Judgment Day, his first sight would not be glory or the magnificent head of God or even the rainbow. It would be his own other eye. Even so, his mother had smiled and shown that willingness to love the man who was responsible for dividing his father up throughout eternity. It wasn't the divinity from the foreman's wife that made him sick. That came later. It was the fact that instead of life insurance, the sawmill owner gave his mother $40 to tide you and them kids over, and she took it happily and bought each of them a big peppermint stick on the very day of the funeral. Guitar's two sisters and baby brother sucked away at the bone-white and blood-red stick. But Guitar couldn't. He held it in his hand until it stuck there. All day he held it, at the graveside, at the funeral supper, all the sleepless night. The others made fun of what they believed was his miserliness. But he could not eat it or throw it away. Until finally, in the outhouse, he'd let it fall into the earth's stinking hole. Once, he said, just once, and felt the nausea all over again. The crunch is here, he said, the big crunch. Don't let them Kennedys fool you, and I'll tell you the truth. I hope your daddy's right about what's in that cave. And I sure hope you don't have no second thoughts about getting it back here. What's that supposed to mean? It mean I'm nervous, real nervous. I need the bread. If you're in a hurt, I can let you have, not me, us. We have work to do, man. And just recently, Guitar squinted his eyes at Milkman. Just recently, one of us was put out in the streets by somebody I don't have to name. And his wages were garnished because that somebody said 2 months' rent was owing. This somebody needs 2 months' rent on a 12-by-12 hole in the wall like a fish needs side pockets. Now we have to take care of this man, get him a place to stay, pay the so-called back rent, and that was my fault. Let me tell you what happened. No, don't tell me nothing. You ain't the landlord. and you didn't put him out. You may have handed him the gun, but you didn't pull the trigger. I'm not blaming you. Why not? You talk about my father, my father's sister, and you'll talk about my sister, too, if I let you. Why, you trust me? Baby, I hope I never have to ask myself that question. It ended all right, that gloomy conversation. There was no real anger, and nothing irrevocable was said. When Milkman left, Guitar opened his palm as usual, and Milkman slapped it. Maybe it was fatigue, but the touching of palms seemed a little weak. At the Pittsburgh airport, he discovered that Danville was 240 miles northeast and not accessible by any public transportation other than a Greyhound bus. Reluctantly, unwilling to give up the elegance he had felt on the flight, he taxied from the airport to the bus station and settled himself for 2 idle hours before the Greyhound left. By the time he boarded, the inactivity, the picture magazines he'd read, the strolls in the streets near the station had exhausted him. He fell asleep 15 minutes outside Pittsburgh. When he woke, it was late in the afternoon, with an hour more to go before he reached Danville. His father had raved about the beauty of this part of the country, but Milkman saw it as merely green, deep into its Indian summer, but cooler than his own city, although it was farther south. The mountains, he thought, must make for the difference in temperature. For a few minutes, he tried to enjoy the scenery running past his window. Then the city man's boredom with nature's repetition overtook him. Some places had lots of trees, some did not. Some fields were green, some were not. And the hills in the distance were like the hills in every distance. Then he watched signs, the names of towns that lay 22 miles ahead, 17 miles to the east, 5 miles to the northeast, and the names of junctions, counties, crossings, bridges, stations, tunnels, mountains, rivers, creeks, landings, parks, and lookout points. Everybody had to do his act, he thought, for surely anybody who was interested in Dudbury Point already knew where it was. He had 2 bottles of Cutty Sark in his suitcase, along with 2 shirts and some underwear. The large suitcase, he thought, would have his real load on the return trip. Now he wished he had not checked it under the bus, for he wanted a drink right then. According to his watch, the gold Longines his mother had given him, it would be another 20 minutes before a stop. He lay back on the headrest and tried to fall asleep. His eyes were creasing from the sustained viewing of uneventful countryside. In Danville, he was astonished to learn that the bus depot was a diner on Route 11, where the counterman sold bus tickets, hamburgers, coffee, cheese, and peanut butter crackers, cigarettes, candy, and a cold-cut plate. No lockers, no baggage room, no taxi, and now he realized no men's room either. Suddenly he felt ridiculous. What was he supposed to do? Put his suitcase down and ask the man, "Where is the cave near the farm where my father lived 58 years ago?" He knew nobody, had no names, except the first name of an old lady who was now dead. And rather than call any more attention to himself in this tiny farming town than his beige three-piece suit, his button-down light blue shirt, and black string tie, and his beautiful Florsheim shoes had already brought. He asked the counterman if he could check his bag there. The man gazed at the suitcase and seemed to be turning the request over in his mind. "I'll pay," said Milkman. "Leave her here. Back of the pop crates," the man said. "When you want to pick her up?" "This evening," he said. "Fine. She'll be right here." Milkman left the diner bus station with a small satchel of shaving things and walked out into the streets of Danville, Pennsylvania. He'd seen places like this in Michigan, of course, but he never had to do anything in them other than buy gas. The three stores on the street were closing up for the night. It was 5:15, and about a dozen people, all told, were walking on the sidewalks. One of them was a Negro, a tall man, elderly, with a brown peaked cap and an old-fashioned collar. Milkman followed him for a while, then caught up to him and said, "Say, I wonder if you could help me?" He smiled as he spoke. The man turned around, but did not answer. Milkman wondered if he had offended him in some way. Finally, the man nodded and said, "Do what I can." He had a slight country lilt, like that of the white man at the counter. "I'm looking for Circe, a lady named Circe." "Well, not her, but her house. Do you know where she used to live? I'm from out of town. I just got off the bus. I have some business to take care of here, an insurance policy, and I need to check on some property out there." The man was listening and apparently not going to interrupt him, so Milkman ended his sentence lamely with, "Can you help me?" "Reverend Cooper would know," said the man. "Where can I find him?" Milkman felt something missing from the conversation. "Stone Lane. Follow this here street till you come to the post office. Go on around the post office, and that'll be Windsor. The next street is Stone Lane. He lives in there." "Will there be a church there?" Milkman assumed a preacher lived next door to his church. "No, no. Church ain't got no parsonage. Reverend Cooper lives in Stone Lane. Yellow House, I believe." "Thanks," said Milkman. "Thanks a lot." "Mighty welcome," said the man. "Good evening." And he walked away. Milkman considered whether to go back for his suitcase, abandoned the idea, and followed the directions given him. An American flag identified the post office, a frame structure next to a drugstore that served also as the Western Union office. He turned left at the corner, but noticed there were no street signs anywhere. How could he find Windsor or Stone Lane if there were no signs? He walked through a residential street, another and another, and he was just about to go back to the drugstore and look under AME or AME Zion in a telephone directory when he saw a yellow and white house. Maybe this is it, he thought. He climbed the steps, determined to mind his manners. A thief should be polite and win goodwill. "Good evening. Is Reverend Cooper here?" A woman was standing in the doorway. "Yes, he's here. Would you like to come in? I'll call him." "Thank you." Milkman entered a tiny hall and waited. A short, chubby man appeared, fingering his glasses. "Yes, sir? You wanted to see me?" His eyes ran rapidly over Milkman's clothes, but his voice betrayed no excessive curiosity. "Yes, how are you?" "Fine, fine. And you?" "Pretty good." Milkman felt as awkward as he sounded. He had never had to try to make a pleasant impression on a stranger before, never needed anything from a stranger before, and did not remember ever asking anybody in the world how they were. "I might as well say it all," he thought. "I could use your help, sir. My name is Macon Dead. My father is from around..." "Dead? Macon Dead, you say?" "Yes." Milkman smiled apologetically for the name. "My father... well, I'll be..." Reverend Cooper took off his glasses. "Well, I'll be..." "Esther?" He threw his voice over his shoulder without taking his eyes off his guest. "Esther, come here." Then to Milkman. "I know your people." Milkman smiled and let his shoulders slump a little. It was a good feeling to come into a strange town and find a stranger who knew your people. All his life, he'd heard the tremor in the word. "I live here, but my people..." Or, "She acts like she ain't got no people." Or, "Do any of your people live there?" But he had known what it meant. Lynx. He remembered Freddie sitting in Sonny's shop just before Christmas saying, "None of my people would take me in." Milkman beamed at Reverend Cooper and his wife. "You do?" "Sit on down here, boy. You the son of the Macon Dead I knew." "Oh, well, now, I don't mean to say I knew him all that well. Your daddy was 4 or 5 years older than me, and they didn't get to town much. But everybody round here remembers the old man. Old Macon Dead, your granddad. My daddy and him was good friends. A blacksmith, my daddy was. I'm the only one got the call." "Well, well, well." Reverend Cooper grinned and massaged his knees. "Oh, Lord, I'm forgetting myself. You must be hungry. Esther, get him something to fill himself up on." "Oh, no. No, thank you, sir. Maybe a little something to drink. I mean, if you do drink, that is." "Sure, sure. Nothing citified, I'm sorry to say, but Esther..." She was on her way to the kitchen. "Bring some glasses and get that whiskey out the cupboard. This here's Macon Dead's boy, and he's tired and he needs a drink. Tell me, how'd you find me? Don't tell me your daddy remembered me." "He probably does, but I met a man in the street, and he told me how to find you." "You asked him for me?" Reverend Cooper wanted to get all the facts straight. Already he was framing the story for his friends, how the man came to his house first, how he asked for him. Esther returned with a Coca-Cola tray, 2 glasses, and a large mayonnaise jar of what looked like water. Reverend Cooper poured it warm and neat into the 2 glasses. No ice, no water, just pure rye whiskey that almost tore Milkman's throat when he swallowed it. "No, I didn't ask for you by name. I asked him if he knew where a woman named Circe used to live." "Circe, yes, Lord, old Circe. He told me to talk to you." Reverend Cooper smiled and poured more whiskey. "Everybody round here knows me, and I know everybody. Well, I know my father stayed with her for a while after his father died. They had a fine place, mighty fine. Some white folks own it now. Course, that's what they wanted. That's why they shot him. Upset a lot of people here, a whole lot of people. Scared him, too. But didn't your daddy have a sister named of Pilot? Yes, sir. Pilot. Still living, is she? Oh, yes. Very much living. Is that so? Pretty girl. Real pretty. My daddy was the one made the earring for her. That's how we knew they was alive. After old Macon Dead was killed, nobody knew whether the children was dead too, or what. Then a few weeks passed, and Cersei came to my daddy's shop, right across from where the post office is now. That's where my daddy's blacksmith shop was. She came in there with this little metal box with a piece of paper bag folded up in it. Pilot's name was written on it. Cersei didn't tell Daddy anything, but that he was to make an earring out of it. She stole a brooch from the folks she worked for. My daddy took the gold pin off it and soldered it to the box, so we knew they was alive and Cersei was taking care of them. They'd be all right with Cersei. She worked for the butlers, rich white folks, you know. But she was a good midwife in those days. Delivered everybody, me included. Maybe it was the whiskey, which always made other people gracious when he drank it. But Milkman felt a glow listening to a story come from this man that he'd heard many times before, but only half listened to. Or maybe it was being there, in the place where it happened, that made it seem so real. Hearing Pilot talk about caves and woods and earrings on Darling Street, or his father talk about cooking wild turkey over the automobile noise of Not Doctor Street, seemed exotic, something from another world and age, and maybe not even true. Here, in the parsonage, sitting in a cane-bottomed chair near an upright piano and drinking homemade whiskey poured from a mayonnaise jar, it was real. Without knowing it, he had walked right by the place where Pilot's earring had been fashioned, the earring that had fascinated him when he was little, the fixing of which informed the colored people here that the children of the murdered man were alive. And this was the living room of the son of the man who made the earring. Did anybody ever catch the men who did it, who killed him? Reverend Cooper raised his eyebrows. Catch? He asked, his face full of wonder. Then he smiled again. Didn't have to catch him. They never went nowhere. I mean, did they have a trial? Were they arrested? Arrested for what? Killing a nigger? Where did you say you was from? You mean nobody did anything? Didn't even try to find out who did it? Everybody knew who did it. Same people Circe worked for. The butlers. And nobody did anything? Milkman wondered at his own anger. He hadn't felt angry when he first heard about it. Why now? Wasn't nothing to do. White folks didn't care. Colored folks didn't dare. Wasn't no police like now. Now we got a county sheriff handles things. Not then. Then the circuit judge came through just once or twice a year. Besides, the people what did it owned half the county. Macon's land was in their way. Folks was just thankful the children escaped. You said Cersei worked for the people who killed him. Did she know that? Of course she did. And she let them stay there? Not out in the open. She hid them. Still, they were in the same house, right? Yep. Best place, I'd say. If they came to town, somebody'd see them. Nobody would think of looking there. Did my father know that? I don't know what he knew. if Circe ever told him. I never saw him after the murder. None of us did. Where are they, the butlers? They still live here? Dead now, every one of them. The last one, the girl Elizabeth, died a couple years back. Barren as a rock, and just as old. Things work out, son. The ways of God are mysterious. But if you live it out, just live it out, you see that it always works out. Nothing they stole or killed for did them a bit of good, not one bit. I don't care whether it did them good. The fact is, they did somebody else harm. Reverend Cooper shrugged. White folks different up your way? No, I guess not. Sometimes, though, you can do something. What? The preacher looked genuinely interested. Milkman couldn't answer except in guitar's words, so he said nothing. See this here? The Reverend turned around and showed Milkman a knot the size of a walnut that grew behind his ear. Some of us went to Philly to try and march in an Armistice Day parade. This was after the First World War. We were invited and had a permit, but the people, the white people, didn't like us being there. They started a fracas, you know, throwing rocks, calling us names, and they didn't care nothing about the uniform. Anyway, some police on horseback came to quiet them down, we thought. They ran us down, right under their horses. This here's what a hoof can do. Ain't that something? Jesus God. You wouldn't be here to even things up, would you? The preacher leaned over his stomach. No, I'm passing through, that's all. Just thought I'd look around. I wanted to see the farm. 'Cause any evening up left to do, Circe took care of. What'd she do? Ha! What didn't she do? Sorry I didn't come out here a long time ago. I would have liked to meet her. She must have been 100 years old when she died. Older was 100 when I was a boy. Is the farm nearby? Milkman appeared mildly interested. Not too far. I sort of wanted to see where it was, since I'm out this way. Daddy talked so much about it. It's right back of the Butler place, about 15 miles out. I can take you there. My old piece of car's in the shop, but it was supposed to be ready yesterday. I'll check on it. Milkman waited 4 days for the car to be ready. 4 days at Reverend Cooper's house as his guest, and the purpose of long visits from every old man in the town who remembered his father or his grandfather, and some who'd only heard. They all repeated various aspects of the story, all talked about how beautiful Lincoln's Heaven was. Sitting in the kitchen, they looked at Milkman with such rheumy eyes and spoke about his grandfather with such awe and affection. Milkman began to miss him, too. His own father's words came back to him. I worked right alongside my father, right alongside him. Milkman thought then that his father was boasting of his manliness as a child. Now he knew he had been saying something else, that he loved his father, had an intimate relationship with him. That his father loved him, trusted him, and found him worthy of working right alongside him. Something went wild in me, he said, when I saw him on the ground. His was a genuine feeling that Milkman had faked when Reverend Cooper described the hopelessness of doing anything. These men remembered both Macondeads as extraordinary men. Pilot, they remembered as a pretty woods wild girl that couldn't nobody put shoes on. Only one of them remembered his grandmother. Good-looking, but looked like a white woman, Indian maybe. Black hair and slanted-up eyes. Died in childbirth, you know. The more the old men talked, the more he heard about the only farm in the county that grew peaches, real peaches, like they had in Georgia. The feasts they had when hunting was over, the pork kills in the winter, and the work, the back-breaking work of a going farm, the more he missed something in his life. They talked about digging a well, fashioning traps, felling trees, warming orchards with fire when spring weather was bad, breaking young horses, training dogs. And in it all was his own father, the second Macon dead, their contemporary, who was strong as an ox, could ride bareback and barefoot, who, they agreed, outran, outplowed, outshot, outpicked, outrode them all. He could not recognize that stern, greedy, unloving man in the boy they talked about. But he loved the boy they described, and loved that boy's father, with his hip-roofed barn, his peach trees, and Sunday break-of-dawn fishing parties in a fish pond that was 2 acres wide. They talked on and on, using Milkman as the ignition that gunned their memories. The good times, the hard times, things that changed, things that stayed the same. And head and shoulders, above all of it, was the tall, magnificent Macon dead, whose death, it seemed to him, was the beginning of their own dying, even though they were young boys at the time. Macon dead was the farmer they wanted to be, the clever irrigator, the peach tree grower, the hog slaughterer, the wild turkey roaster, the man who could plow 40 in no time flat, and sang like an angel while he did it. He had come out of nowhere, as ignorant as a hammer and broke as a convict, with nothing but free papers, a Bible, and a pretty black-haired wife. And in 1 year, he'd leased 10 acres. The next, 10 more. 16 years later, he had one of the best farms in Montour County, a farm that colored their lives like a paintbrush and spoke to them like a sermon. "You see," the farm said to them, see what you can do? Never mind, you can't tell one letter from another. Never mind you born a slave. Never mind you lose your name. Never mind your daddy dead. Never mind nothing. Here, this here's what a man can do if he puts his mind to it and his back in it. Stop sniveling, it said. Stop picking around the edges of the world. Take advantage. And if you can't take advantage, take disadvantage. We live here, on this planet, in this nation, in this county, right here, nowhere else. We got a home in this rock. Don't you see? Nobody starving in my home. Nobody crying in my home. And if I got a home, you got one too. Grab it. Grab this land. Take it. Hold it, my brothers. Make it, my brothers. Shake it. Squeeze it. Turn it. Twist it. Beat it. Kick it. Kiss it. Whip it, stomp it, dig it, plow it, seed it, reap it, rent it, buy it, sell it, own it, build it, multiply it, and pass it on. Can you hear me? Pass it on. But they shot the top of his head off and ate his fine Georgia peaches. And even as boys, these men began to die. And were dying still. Looking at Milkman in those nighttime talks, they yearned for something, some word from him that would rekindle the dream and stop the death they were dying. That's why Milkman began to talk about his father, the boy they knew, the son of the fabulous Macon Dead. He bragged a little, and they came alive. How many houses his father owned? They grinned. The new car every 2 years. They laughed. And when he told them how his father tried to buy the Erie Lackawanna, it sounded better that way. They hooted with joy. That's him. That's old Macon Dead's boy, all right. They wanted to know everything, and Milkman found himself rattling off assets like an accountant, describing deals, total rents income, bank loans, and this new thing his father was looking into, the stock market. Suddenly, in the midst of his telling, Milkman wanted the gold. He wanted to get up right then and there and go get it, run to where it was, and snatch every grain of it from under the noses of the butlers, who were dumb enough to believe that if they killed one man, his whole line died. He glittered in the light of their adoration and grew fierce with pride. "Who's your daddy, Mary?" "The daughter of the richest Negro doctor in town." "That's him. That's Macon Dead." "Send you all to college?" "Sent my sisters. I work right alongside him in our office." "Ha! Keep you home to get that money. Macon Dead gonna always make him some money." "What kind of car you drive?" "Buick, 225. "Great God, a deuce and a quarter." "What year?" "This year." "That's him. That's Macon Dead. He gonna buy the Erie Lackawanna. If he want it, he'll get it. Bless my soul. Bet he worry them white folks to death. Can't nobody keep him down. Not no Macon Dead. Not in this world. And not in the next. Oh, goddamn. The Erie Lackawanna." After all the waiting, Reverend Cooper couldn't go. His preaching income was supplemented by freight yard work, and he was called for an early shift. His nephew, called nephew, since he was their only one, was assigned to drive Milkman out to the farm, as close as they could get. Nephew was 13 and barely able to see over the steering wheel. "Does he have a license?" Milkman asked Mrs. Cooper. "Not yet," she said, and when she saw his consternation, she explained that farm kids drove early. They had to. Milkman and nephew started out right after breakfast. It took them the better part of an hour because the roads were curving two lanes, and they spent 20 minutes behind a light truck they couldn't pull around. Nephew spoke very little. He seemed interested only in Milkman's clothes, which he took every opportunity to examine. Milkman decided to give him one of his shirts and asked him to stop by the bus station to pick up the suitcase he'd left there. Finally, nephew slowed down on a stretch of road that showed no houses at all. He stopped. "What's the matter? You want me to drive?" "No, sir. This is it." "What's it? Where?" "Back in there." He pointed to some bushes. "The road to the Butler place is in there, and the farm's back behind it. You gotta walk it. Car won't make it." Nothing was truer, as it turned out. Milkman's feet could hardly make it over the stony road, covered with second growth. He had asked nephew to wait, thinking he would survey the area quickly and come back later on his own. But the boy had chores, he said, and would be back whenever Milkman wanted him to be there. "An hour," said Milkman. "Take me an hour just to get back to town," said nephew. "Reverend Cooper said you were to take me," not leave me stranded. My mama whipped me. I don't do my chores. Milkman was annoyed, but because he didn't want the boy to think he was nervous about being left out there alone, he agreed to having him come back at, he glanced at his heavy, over-designed watch, at noon. It was 9 o'clock then. His hat had been knocked off by the first branches of the old walnut trees, so he held it in his hand. His cuffless pants were darkened by the mile-long walk over moist leaves. The quiet fairly roared in his ears. He was uncomfortable and a little anxious, but the gold loomed large in his mind, as did the faces of the men he'd drunk with last night, and he stepped firmly onto the gravel and leaves of the driveway, which circled the biggest house he'd ever seen. This is where they stayed, he thought, where Pilate cried when given cherry jam. He stood still a moment. It must have been beautiful. Must have seemed like a palace to them. But neither had ever spoken of it in any terms but how imprisoned they felt. How difficult it was to see the sky from their room. How repelled they were by the carpets, the draperies. Without knowing who killed their father, they instinctively hated the murderer's house. And it did look like a murderer's house. Dark, ruined, evil. Never, not since he knelt by his window sill, wishing he could fly, had he felt so lonely. He saw the eyes of a child peer at him over the sill of the one second-story window the ivy had not covered. He smiled. Must be myself I'm seeing, thinking about how I used to watch the sky out the window. Or maybe it's the light trying to get through the trees. 4 graceful columns supported the portico, and the huge double door featured a heavy brass knocker. He lifted it and let it fall. The sound was soaked up like a single raindrop in cotton. Nothing stirred. He looked back down the path and saw the green maw out of which he had come, a greenish-black tunnel, the end of which was nowhere in sight. The farm, they said, was right in back of the Butler place, but knowing how different their concept of distance was, he thought he'd better get moving. If he found what he was looking for, he would have to come back at night, with equipment, of course, but also with some familiarity with the area. On impulse, he reached out his hand and tried to turn the doorknob. It didn't budge. Half turning to leave, literally as an afterthought, he pushed the door, and it swung open with a sigh. He leaned in. The smell prevented him from seeing anything more than the absence of light did. A hairy animal smell. Ripe, rife, suffocating. He coughed and looked for somewhere to spit, for the odor was in his mouth, coating his teeth and tongue. He pulled a handkerchief from his back pocket, held it over his nose, backed away from the open door, and had just begun to spill the little breakfast he'd eaten when the odor disappeared. And quite suddenly, in its place was a sweet, spicy perfume, like ginger root, pleasant, clean, seductive. Surprised and charmed by it, he retraced his steps and went inside. After a second or two, he was able to see the hand-laid and hand-finished wooden floor in a huge hall. and at its farther end, a wide staircase spiraling up into the dark. His eyes traveled up the